The afternoon, which is case number 72518, State of Nevada, Office of the Military versus William Simpson. Okay, you also notice Justice Pickering is participating. She's on video from Las Vegas, so she may have some questions involved during the course of this argument. So if the parties are ready to proceed, Mr. Smith, why don't you go ahead, and would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jordan Smith, the Office of the Military, I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal and I'll keep an eye on the clock.
Okay.
This case is a perfect example of why the legislature did not authorize hearing officers to second guess the employment decisions of the executive branch. Here we have an employment authority that was making a concerted effort to root out a deep-seated culture of sexual harassment in the profession, and a hearing officer commended the employment authority for firing a supervisor that had been part of the problem for 10 years. Including sending and viewing pornographic material at issue in this case. Under serious circumstances like these, appointing authorities must have the power to terminate employees that create an uncomfortable or hostile work environment, potentially subject the state to liability. Hearing officers are unconnected with day-to-day requirements and necessities of operating a public agency. They should not be allowed to reverse disciplinary decisions when there is substantial evidence that misconduct actually occurred. And that's the balance struck by the legislature in NRS Chapter 284. And that balance is reflected in two provisions, 284.385 and 284.390. Under those two provisions, an appointing authority may dismiss any permanent classified employee when the appointing authority considers the good of the public service to be served thereby. Under the plain reading of that statute, it's the appointing authority's determination. It's the appointing authority's call whether the good of the public service will be served by the disciplinary action. Hearing officers under 390 are limited to reviewing for just cause and reasonableness. So, of course, the question is then, what are hearing officers allowed to do under reasonableness? What are they allowed to do under just cause? And here, all the parties are in agreement about the meaning of just cause, unlike cases like the O'Keefe case that's also pending before this court. Here, parties agree that just cause means what this court said it means in Southwest Gas versus Florida. There, this court defined just cause as one that's not arbitrary, capricious, or illegal. It's one supported by substantial evidence, and two, reasonably believed by the employer to be true. So all the parties here agree that when a hearing officer is engaging in a just cause analysis, hearing officers are reviewing for substantial evidence of legal cause to dismiss. Everybody's in agreement on that page. But then Mr. Simpson makes kind of an odd argument, which was echoed by the district court. And the argument by Mr. Simpson's at page 13 of his responsive brief, and it's the district court's order at page 407 of the record. Mr. Simpson argues that there's no authority for the proposition that a violation of a policy or regulation constitutes just cause. But by administrative regulation, NAC 284.646, viewing or distributing pornography in the workplace is cause to terminate as a matter of law. So if there's substantial evidence and a just cause analysis of a violation of that regulation, there's just cause to dismiss by definition. That's why on appeal, Mr. Simpson pivots for the first time to arguing that the image at issue does not satisfy the definition of pornographic material. That issue was actually conceded by Mr. Simpson below in footnotes in both his opposition to the motion to stay and his response to the petition for judicial review. He conceded in footnotes that the image technically qualifies as pornographic material. He made the same representation to this court in footnote 3 of his motion to dismiss the appeal. Or again, he said that the image technically constitutes pornographic material of any armies, but there's worse things on the internet. He did agree that technically it satisfied pornographic material. And because there's substantial evidence that the image constitutes pornographic material and that it was viewed or distributed in the workplace, just cause is established as a matter of law. That's why this court doesn't have to look to the definition of legal cause that's in the Rust decision, which goes back to 1940 in the Welliver decision, because administrative regulation, viewing or distributing pornography, is cause as a matter of law.
Okay. Mr. Smith, what about the mootness issue? What's your position on that that's raised by the respondent?
That's right. The only thing, so when the briefing occurred, there were two arguments for why the case is not moot. One, Mr. Simpson retained reemployment rights for a year, and two, he'd been given back pay. Since the end of briefing, three employment rights have expired, but he was still, when he was reinstated, he was paid back pay for the time he was not employed. And the state still has the ability to recoup those amounts under NRS 353C.195. Under that statute, state controller is the debt collection agent for all state agencies. And so if this court argues or finds, if this court finds that his reinstatement is erroneous, the state can attempt to collect the actual amount of money. I know below there are some representations in the briefing that were incomplete about whether the state had the ability to do that. If you look at NRS 353C.195, it says there's not a specific statute for the foreign agency that the controller acts as a debt collection agent. Here, there's no specific statute that allows the Office of the Military to collect those amounts, but that means that then the Office of the Military just referred those amounts to the state controller. So it's not moot, it's still a dispute over the debt collection.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Smith, could you address the, once again, the authority that the legislature gave to the hearing officer to hear these matters under 284.390? Specifically, what I'm concerned about is the approach this court took in Knapp, which holds that generally a hearing officer does not defer to the appointing authority's decision. It seems like this court in Knapp approved of a second-guessing and, frankly, from my point of view, an untethered second-guessing of the decisions made by the appointing authority. I guess, A, what is the authority of a hearing officer from your perspective? And B, if it is non-deferential, then should this court revisit the Knapp opinion?
I agree with Your Honor that Knapp, the statement in Knapp that generally a hearing officer does not defer to appointing authority's decision is untethered from what the statute actually says. If you look at NRS 284.385, it's the appointing authority who's vested with the authority to make the good of the public service determination. So hearing officers under statute should be giving deference to appointing authorities. Under 390, hearing officers would be for just cause and reasonableness. Just cause, as I was describing under topless gas, implies a substantial evidence standard of review. Reasonableness also implies a substantial evidence standard of review. This court recognized that in the Siri versus Chiropractic Board, where it says substantial evidence conveys a reasonableness standard of review. Reasonableness and substantial evidence are defined with reference to each other. So the only issue before a hearing officer in one of these hearings is whether there is substantial evidence, one, to support finding of misconduct, so whether the hearing officer had substantial, or excuse me, whether the appointing authority had before it substantial evidence that misconduct actually occurred. That's the only issue before the hearing officer. Another way of thinking about it is hearing officer's review to determine whether there's substantial evidence to support the appointing authority's decision to good of the public service. And that's the approach this court took back in 1979 in the Lipinski decision. In the Lipinski decision, the court said that the determinative issue in this case is whether substantial evidence was placed before the city council from which the city council could make a finding that legal cause existed. There, the city council was acting in the same capacity as the hearing officers act here. So the only issue before the hearing officer is whether there is substantial evidence to support the appointing authority's decision. Hearing officers, whether it's under the rubric of just cause or the rubric of reasonableness, hearing officers are not engaging in de novo counterbalancing. And the court's statement in Knapp is just simply incorrect. I think this court should overrule Knapp. Knapp relied upon Justice Springer's dissent in Dredge, where Justice Springer said hearing officers are supposed to take a new and impartial view of the evidence. Respectfully to Justice Springer, his statement and his dissent wasn't supported by authority either. If you look at what Dredge actually said, Dredge says it was the task of the hearing officer to determine whether the Department of Prisons, the agency there, the Department of Prisons' decision to terminate is based upon evidence that would enable the Department of Prisons to conclude.
I have a question about the Knapp Dredge issue. Chapter 284 contemplates the hearing officer taking additional and new evidence. Would you agree with me?
There is a hearing, that's correct.
And that occurred in this case. It was an evidentiary hearing that hearing officer Levitt conducted.
That's correct. There were, I believe, three witnesses.
So it is not an appellate review of a cold record for substantial evidence, is it?
No, Your Honor. Well, I'll point this out. Nothing under regulations required the involved type of hearings that these things typically are engaged in. If you look at what the regulations actually require for hearing officers to do, the process that hearing officers are to follow, nothing requires these multi-day evidentiary hearings with multiple witnesses. They have turned into that, and nothing by regulation requires that. If you look at NRS 284.390, I believe it's subsection 4, technical rules of evidence do not apply. So, although these hearings have turned into sort of the spectacle that they have, nothing requires that. Point of these hearings.
Right, but 284.391 actually contemplates issuance of subpoenas and discovery and so on and so forth. It seems to me that the statutory construct is inconsistent with the deferential, any substantial evidence review for which you're contending on the regulations. And if it's a statute versus the regulation conflict, the statute would carry, I would think. So I'm struggling a bit with how you square all this up. And I've always read Drudge to say that it's limited to its facts, you know, the prison setting, the safety concerns, and so on and so forth. So make your case for why the hearing officer would ever issue subpoenas and conduct new evidentiary hearings if indeed it's any substantial evidence deferential review.
Sure. The point of the hearing is to determine to ensure that appointing authorities weren't just firing state employees, classified employees, for no reason. So the reason you're allowed to conduct discovery, allowed to put on witnesses, is to corroborate that, yes, in fact, the appointing authority had before it evidence from which it could make the findings that it did and to impose the discipline that it did. I don't read the statutes as saying simply because you can have these discovery processes that it's a de novo standard of review. I think the purpose of those discovery processes is just a way for the hearing officer to ensure that, yes, in fact, what the appointing authority is saying the employee did, there's evidence that the employee actually did those things. But it's not a de novo standard of review. And to address your point between the conflict between regulations and statutes, one point on Drudge. Nothing in Chapter 284 differentiates between appointing authorities. There's nothing in 284, the plain language, that says security program appointing authorities get deference, but all other appointing authorities do not get deference. I mean, Chapter 284.
But don't you think that kind of gets into the reasonableness job that is assigned to the hearing officer? It's more than just was there any substantial evidence to support the termination, but was that, based on the evidence, reasonable? And in this case, I think, I don't know why we have hearing officers. If we adopt your position, a court could as easily review deferentially for any substantial evidence. The hearing officer is determining reasonableness and just cause. And I grant you that there's probably some deference owed with the degree of deference depending on safety concerns and the like, but that would be subsumed under reasonableness, wouldn't it?
Reasonableness, as the Eighth Circuit decision that we cite in our supplemental authorities points out, reasonableness and substantial evidence are really two sides of the same coin. When a court or a hearing officer is reviewing for reasonableness, they are reviewing for substantial evidence. Substantial evidence is a quantification of the reasonableness standard. So when 390 subsection 6, now subsection 7, says reasonableness, hearing officers are reviewing for substantial evidence. So it's not a de novo review. I'm unaware of any case where a reasonableness standard has allowed a re-weighing or de novo type review. So I think under reasonableness, hearing officers are still assessing whether there was substantial evidence in front of the appointing authority.
Mr. Smith, you have about a minute. Over a minute. We took up some of your time, so you'd like to observe your balance. We'll add 2 minutes to your time, and then Mr. Donaldson will add 2 minutes to his time as well to present his case. Mr. Donaldson?
Thank you, Your Honors. If it may please the Court, Thomas J. Donaldson from the Dyer Lawrence Law Firm here in Carson City on behalf of Respondent William Simpson. Basically, from what I hear, and if I may, I know that you reserved ruling on my motion to dismiss. If I may reserve 2 minutes at the end of the argument to reply to that, those issues.
Fortunately, you can't because you're the respondent. You don't have a cross appeal, so you can't do that. But as far as the motion, we do have it, and it'll be addressed probably when we deal with the entire case. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to hear the arguments first. And
thank you. Based on what I heard just now, and I think it's fairly novel arguments that aren't in the briefing, is that the state now wants to take away post-probationary status of all state employees, classified state employees in Nevada, by doing away with the hearing officer process altogether. Well, that's not what the statutes provide. Specifically, NRS 284, 380 and 375. It's clear that even under Nevada and U.S. Supreme Court under Laudermill, these are classified employees who have passed their probationary period. They're entitled to a hearing, a due process hearing, prior to having that post-probationary property interest taken away, deprived. So if you adopt, as Justice Pickering pointed out, the state's position, they want to do away with the whole hearing officer process in NRS 284. And that's absurd in this type of proceeding to make that argument when this, frankly, case is a total waste of time to start with.
How should we review cases like this when the hearing officer took additional evidence and testimony? How do we put that in our calculus on the standard of review? What would you advocate?
It's a complete evidentiary hearing at the hearing officer level. I do one of these hearings every other week here in Nevada for state employees. The hearing officer is there to make an evidentiary record, to have witnesses testify, to take exhibits, to create a record for then the district court to review, and then, if necessary, for yourselves to review.
And the hearing officer in this case concluded that your client had conducted or committed misconduct, right?
Correct.
So at issue in this case is whether that misconduct warrants what particular level of discipline. And in that regard, why shouldn't that determination be made by the appointing agency? Why is the level of discipline established by a hearing officer rather than the appointing agency?
The appointing authority.
There are distinctly different roles. As appellant's counsel argues, the facts that give rise to whether there is or isn't misconduct is a separate assessment from what flows from those facts. Would you agree with that?
As Justice Pickering points out, the hearing officer's job is to determine whether there's reasonableness. And that's all there is. The appointing authority can only make a recommendation for the level of discipline. That recommendation, you'll see it in the specificity of charges, the recommended level of discipline is what the appointing authority can do. Then there's a pre-disciplinary hearing, and if the director of the particular agency or department then imposes the recommended discipline, then the employee can file an appeal under 288, NRS Chapter 288. Then the reasonableness standard applies. Both the reasonableness and the just cause standards then apply to any disciplinary action recommended by the appointing authority. And I think the prior authorities are very clear that there is no need for a hearing officer, a district court, or yourselves to give any deference whatsoever to that recommended level of discipline if the serious, egregious security concerns, substantial evidence of it even, it does not exist under Dredge and Jackson. So there's no need in statute or in prior Nevada Supreme Court decisions for any hearing officer or any level of the appellate process to give any deference to an appointing authority's recommended level of discipline. But I think the major issue here is the mootness and, frankly, the frivolousness of this appeal. Here we're talking about a 10-year exemplary employee, 17 years of law enforcement without any priors, no discipline, no substandard evaluations, over one text sent from a personal cell phone off to an off-duty employee personal cell phone of a nude male. I mean, that's what they solely based the termination upon, and it was solely based upon the Office of the Military's own prohibitions and penalties that do not provide for dismissal for a violation. So I agree that the hearing officer did determine that there was a violation, but under the Office of the Military's own prohibitions and penalties, that cannot substantiate, or even they can't even recommend dismissal for a violation. So that's why we're here today. And then we have...
Excuse me, I want to question your statement. Why can't they dismiss this individual once they find that that conduct occurred and it is misconduct?
Because under their own prohibitions and penalties, there's only one cited in the specificity of charges, and that's basically misconduct by a supervisor. Under that matrix, in their own prohibitions and penalties under disciplinary action, and I'd have to get you the citation in the record, but under that policy, the only recommended range of penalties for a violation of that class of an offense is a reprimand to a suspension under their own matrix. So the only internal prohibition and penalty cited in the specificity does not allow them, the Office of the Military, to go toward dismissal in this case. Yet they totally ignored that. They totally ignored that at the hearing. They totally ignored that throughout this appeal. They don't think that they have to comply with their own policies and procedures, which frankly is foolish, given that they have to, that's why they're there. They supplement the NACs, they specify their own prohibitions and penalties that their employees have to provide by, have to follow, have to apply, and yet they totally ignore that in this case. But the mootness, I think that can't be overcome. Here the Office of the Military unilaterally did away with these positions. Just, I think, days before filing the notice of appeal, including Officer Simpson's. Yes, he exercised his recall rights, but that expired in March of this year. There's no possibility that he's going to get a state offer for reemployment at this point, let alone that the Office of the Military is required to take him back at this point. And then are two-faced in the way that they argue that they can or cannot collect the pay that was paid to Officer Simpson over the years. In fact, it was almost one full year. He was off for a very brief time between his effective date of his termination and hearing Officer Levitt's decision, and then ultimately was put back to work after the District Court Judge Russell denied their stay, which in their stay motion, they argued they should get a stay because there's no provision for the state to collect back pay if the district court was to overturn hearing Officer Levitt's decision.
So,
yet now today, they totally flip sides.
Well, that kind of intrigued me, Mr. Donaldson. Mr. Smith's arguing that the state could sue to get this money back. What's your position on that?
At this point, how just would that be? Here we are a
year. Is it legally impossible for the state to do that under some doctrine of law or something you want to call to our attention?
It's the same authorities that are cited in their motion to stay that it's not allowed under Nevada law. If you look at that motion in the record, they cite authorities, and I don't have them today because I frankly didn't think this was a major issue, but that those authorities, and that's what they argued to the district court, to Judge Russell, that's why he should grant them a stay, is because they are unable to collect back pay from a now former state employee who's sitting out there, who could have gone back to work, could have continued to serve the people of the state and the Office of the Military throughout the appeal, both at district court and now, but then they turn around and eliminate the position, making this unilaterally moot. There's no way around that.
Are you arguing that the state's taken an inconsistent position in this case on that issue, so therefore they shouldn't be entitled to prevail on that particular point?
Totally unfair and unjust. If they're going to argue at one court one position, then totally turn around and argue another, supposedly on different authorities, when there was, and they've consistently made this argument throughout the years in district court petitions for judicial review to try to get a stay, and I can think of very few that district court judges ever granted, but that's exactly what they're doing in this case.
You mentioned, sir, that the recall rights expired in March of this year. I may have misheard you because I'm struggling a bit with the audio, but could you elaborate on that if you have in mind what I'm asking about?
Indeed. Under NRS 284-380 sub 4, when basically a state employee is laid off, they have a couple of different options. And if you look at Exhibit 1 to my motion to dismiss this case, the state gave Officer Simpson those options in March of last year, February or March of last year. It might have been January. But the effective date of his layoff, the elimination of his position, was March, well, it was originally March 6th or something, and then they had to extend that to March 12th because they didn't know what they were doing. So as of 1 year later, under NAC 284-630, the employee is only on that list for recall for 1 year. So as okay. of March 13th, 2018, Officer Simpson has no more rights of recall to state employment under the statute and under the regulations. So there's no controversy anymore. If you look at even the decisions, the Wedekind decision cited by the state in this case, no existing rights for the court's decision, and it's an abstract question, and frankly, it's an advisory opinion, I believe, if the court was to issue a decision on the merits at this time under these facts.
Mr. Donaldson.
So you're saying there's no possible gain for the state unless the court were to credit its new position that it can sue for back pay that's been paid?
Yes, contrary to the state's argument at the district court.
Yeah, but it didn't carry in the district court because the district court denied the stay, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
And do you know if that pleading is part of our record here?
Whether what is?
The opposition to the motion to stay in the district court, is that part of our record here?
I believe the entire district court record is. Frankly, I didn't have time to review it entirely in preparations for today, trying to keep Mr. Simpson's costs down, but I believe it is.
Okay.
So, getting back to the legal standard, there has to be a prejudice, have to be a substantial right of appellants, of appellant being prejudiced. Here we have a 17-year law enforcement officer, 10 extraordinary, excellent years of service to the Office of the Military, no prior discipline, meets and exceeds standard evaluations, frankly, reinstating responding clearly was in the best interest of the state of Nevada, both by hearing Officer Levitt and affirmed by District Court Judge Russell. There's no further need for any type of analysis, frankly, but to start with, there's no deference needed whatsoever to any, again, recommended level of discipline by the Office of Military in this case, because this is not a Department of Corrections case. There's no security breach issue. Again, no deference necessary to the Office of the Military. Just cause either
progressive discipline. There's a mandate, as I read 284-383, that I think that's the statute, that the they consider progressive discipline, and that was important to hearing Officer Levitt as well as mentioned by Judge Russell. Could you comment on that?
Yes, and not only under NRS 284 and NAC 284, but again, under the Office of the Military's own prohibitions and penalties, the same regulation that they cited for the sole basis for Officer Simpson's termination also requires progressive discipline. Progressive discipline starts with after a letter of instruction, which isn't technically discipline in Nevada, it's a written reprimand. And again, under the Office of the Military's prohibition penalties, then the next level is a written reprimand, a suspension with or with or suspension, disciplinary suspension with pay, a demotion, and last but not least, a dismissal. And again, for the violation that's alleged, dismissal is not one of the recommended disciplinary actions.
I have a question about another employee and the way they were disciplined. There's reference to a vulgar cupcake thing on a state computer by a coworker who evidently received a warning of some sort. Was that evidence just before hearing Officer Levitt, or do you know if the agency considered that evidence when it initially decided to terminate Mr. Simpson?
Frankly, I don't recall how that evidence came out. I know that there was, and typically I asked for a summary of prior disciplinary actions from the agencies when a client appeals a disciplinary action for similar allegations. And I believe there was evidence that four other Office of the Military employees were either investigated or disciplined for misconduct related to sexual improprieties, if you will. The one that you were talking about was the only one that technically the...
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Technically the only one that discipline was imposed, because the other ones either resigned during the investigation or after the fact. And in fact, the one that was had other pornography on his computer was MSO Poole, who brought the matter to the attention of the Office of the Military to try to save his job, I guess, and then brought this to light, which then resulted in the unlawful termination, which was overturned by hearing Officer Levitt. So we'd ask that you reinstate or confirm Judge Russell's decision that confirmed hearing Officer Levitt's decision that reversed the Office of the Military's recommended termination of officers.
Mr. Donaldson, I had one area of clarification, if I may, yes. Justice Gibbons. I understand your reference to the progressive discipline, but what is the effect of Provost Colvitt's letter of instruction regarding sexual comments and innuendos in the workplace, and then your client's letter to military officers indicating and confirming the state's zero tolerance policy in this area and the warnings contained in those communications? It seems like those set the standards that violation or misconduct in this area means immediate dismissal.
And I respectfully disagree. There is no zero tolerance policy for this type of conduct in the state. There's clearly none by the Office of the Military in the prohibitions and penalties. If you look through there, there's nothing that is anything close to what Provost directed Officer Simpson to convey to the troops, if you will, in the Office of the Military. You also have to keep in mind that Officer Simpson and Officer Poole had known each other for years. And this was totally, in fact, had Mr. Simpson not fallen on his sword in this case and admitted to sending that, the Office of the Military wouldn't have any evidence of any violation whatsoever. In fact, it's unclear where Officer Simpson was when he sent this text from his personal cell phone to MSO Poole's cell phone while MSO Poole was off duty. Officer Simpson thinks he knows he was on break. He recalls being in his truck, and he may have been in the parking lot of the Office of the Military. Had he driven to the convenience store, gone to the out of the parking lot, there'd be no connection whatsoever to any violation, any of the employment by the Office of the Military in this case, and that's the one little string that this whole case is relying upon. And to jump over all the prior discipline requirement, no progressive discipline, and to go straight to termination of a 10-year exemplary employee is exactly why NRS 284 exists, for protection of post-probationary classified state employees in Nevada.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Cork, if you'd add another minute to Mr. Smith's time, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the issue of progressive discipline. NRS 284.383 says progressive discipline applies except in cases of serious violations of law or regulation. Here, NAC 284.646-2A defines intentionally viewing or distributing pornography on the work premises as an immediately terminable offense. So by definition, it is a serious violation of law or regulation, and progressive discipline does not apply. Mr. Simpson latches on to the use of the word may in the regulation and in NRS 284.385 as somehow giving the hearing officer discretion. But if there's discretion whether or not to terminate, that discretion under NRS 284.385 belongs to the appointing authority. And to Justice Hardesty's question about the effect of these memos about zero tolerance, and there is a memo about zero tolerance. Mr. Simpson himself sent it, saying zero tolerance about sexual issues, including on personal devices, and that's at page 40 of the record. The effect of those memos is to explain to employees how this appointing authority is going to exercise its discretion. Mr. Simpson's correct that termination is not mandatory, but to the extent there's any discretion, that discretion belongs to the appointing authority under the statutory scheme. Even the Office of the Military's prohibitions and penalties say that, and that's at page 25 of the record, it says that progressive discipline will be followed except in cases of serious violation. So if there's particularly egregious cases, as the appointing authority in this case judged this text message for, progressive discipline does not apply. This idea that simply because the prohibition and penalty doesn't allow for termination, somehow Mr. Simpson can't be terminated, that argument's unfounded. Think of prohibition and penalty violation as a type of lesser included offense. Here, the appointing authority found substantial evidence that Mr. Simpson committed a terminable offense under the administrative code, 284.646. Simply because he violated something else that has a lesser punishment does not mean Mr. Simpson cannot be terminated. It's the equivalent of a lesser included offense here.
Okay. Mr. Smith, can I ask you again about the issue of the mootness? Now, I think counsel's arguing that, or maybe not, but I think the gist of it was that in the motion for stay, the state argued to Judge Russell that they had no adequate remedy unless the district court granted a stay. The judge didn't do it because you said you won't be able to collect the money, and now you're saying it's not moot because you do have a right to go collect the money. Please enlighten us on that.
Certainly. Real quick, to Justice Hardesty's question, yes, that motion is in the record at 286.
Okay.
And as the point I made, I was attempting to make earlier, was it's true that argument was made in the motion to stay that practically and legally there isn't a way for the department to collect its money. But as Justice Pickering, I think, was alluding to, that argument didn't prevail below. So there's no sort of estoppel argument, but we had successfully advanced an argument and now we're switching positions. I think it's more accurate to say that what was argued below was incorrect or incomplete, not necessarily a switching of positions. Under NRS 353C.195, again, the controller is the collection agency, unless there's a specific statute to the Office of the Military. So the statement that there's no specific statute for the Office of the Military, that is accurate. There isn't anything that's directly on point to this particular agency. But in those cases, you can turn a debt over to the state controller's office to collect that debt for you. So as a legal matter, it's not impossible for the state, if this court were to say that Mr. Simpson was awarded back pay incorrectly, the state has a mechanism to recover that. There's been no prejudice or detrimental reliance on that argument below since the argument shouldn't have been fired in the first place. Whether the state has the ability to collect back pay or not hasn't prejudiced in any way.
Have you considered the argument that the inconsistent argument in the district court and the with the argument here about whether the state has the ability to collect the money would rise to the level of judicial estoppel? Should the state be judicially estopped from maintaining those inconsistent positions?
That argument hasn't been briefed, but judicial estoppel has to do with an argument where I believe it's where you successfully advance an argument below. So to be a judicially estopped, you have to have made an argument, prevailed on that argument, and then switch sides later on down the line. Here, the argument, which I believe more accurately was incomplete, wasn't successfully advanced below. So it's not changing an argument after the state has already won on that front. By no means is the state arguing that there should be no hearing officers whatsoever. The state is simply arguing that the role of the hearing officer should be circumscribed to what the statute requires. NRS 284.390 says hearing officers are limited to reviewing for just cause and for reasonableness. And both of those terms require the appointing authority, the hearing officer, to give deference to the appointing authority by only reviewing for substantial evidence before the appointing, reviewing for substantial evidence that was before the appointing authority.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith. I think we understand your point on that.
Justice Gibbons?
Yes, Justice.
I have one.
Please.
I'm sorry.
Please go
ahead. I want to return to NRS 284.383 and counsel's argument briefly with regard to serious violations of law or regulations and ask him what would be a non-serious violation of law or regulation in his estimation. I mean, to me, he seems to be saying if it's almost a And Ipsy Dixit, if there's a violation of law or regulation, it's a serious violation because it violates a law or regulation.
No, I understand Your Honor's point, so let me clarify. Under NAC 284.646 subsection 2, I believe there are six categories that are immediately terminable. So I would say those six categories are the serious violations of law or regulation. 284.646.1 refers to other causes in 284.650, and there's a longer list of causes in NAC 284.650. Those aren't necessarily serious violations of law or regulations that warrant dismissal. Those are ones that are punishable. But I will say this: under 284.650 subsection 1, even the causes in 650, that longer list, those can be, under certain circumstances, serious enough for dismissal. But that longer list are those that aren't serious by law, but those can be serious by circumstance. And that's what 646.1b says. You can terminate for those if the conditions or the offense are serious enough. So all of those are causes which can be terminable, but the ones that are serious as a matter of law are listed in 646 subsection 2. So that's the difference. It's not circular. But I would again emphasize that the longer list in 650, those can be serious and terminable offenses given the circumstances, but the ones in subsection 2 of 646 are serious as a matter of law.
Thank you. That helps.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith, and this matter will